Then we'll get you one too, then.
Let me know when you're ready.
I'll share. You can use it together.
You ready, Kathy? Kathy?
One second and I will be. This just takes forever. Yep. Perfect, thank you.
Okay, I guess we'll get started. I call this Human Services Committee meeting to order on Tuesday, December 6th, 2022, at 6:01 PM. The roll call is going around the table. If you could please sign in, I believe all committee members are present. First item on the agenda is citizen comments. Do we have any citizen comments?
I do.
Go ahead.
Please, go ahead.
Thank you. What do you want?
If you want to have a seat or stand up on the table. Please state your name and address for the record.
Sure, my name is Kevin Mathewson, 5606 Sixth Avenue, Suite 2295, Kenosha, Wisconsin. I'm here as a taxpayer and a citizen journalist. I'm here to tell you that the Kenosha County DCFS system is broken. Over the years, I have encountered many serious deficiencies within DCFS, and I've recently published a couple stories about some really egregious and terrible mistakes that were made by DCFS. And since then, the floodgates have just kind of opened, and I'm getting my hands on all this information, police reports. And I'm sorry to say that I have reason to believe that the deficient actions of DCFS have caused a child in Kenosha County to die. So I'm going to be sharing that with you folks and the rest of Kenosha as soon as I get the police reports that can verify all the information. But it brings me no joy to report that to you, but it will be. As with any DCFS system in the state, you're going to have a lot of people that have bad things to say, right? Because, you know, part of DCF's job, and I'm not politically correct, but you got to get kids out of the hands of bad parents. So those bad parents, a lot of times have animosity towards DCFS, but a lot of times those are necessary decisions that are made for the interest of the children. And there's always going to be mistakes, so I'm not going to sit here and say there shouldn't be mistakes. The problem is when those mistakes are made, there's no accountability. There's no discipline. There's no letters and files. I had a meeting with Ron Rogers and a county board supervisor a few years ago, and Mr. Rogers seemed to be very cognizant of a big mistake that was made and said there's going to be a letter and a file. Well, the new county board supervisor in that district followed up and realized no such thing happened. So we were misled. And his boss doesn't seem to really respond or care either. And I encourage you all to watch a Netflix documentary called The Trials of Gabriel Fernandez. The problem with when you have a broken DCFS system is it's hard to fix from the outside. There's no public transparency, there's no media accountability, because when I point out a mistake to them of something that their staff does terribly that leads to, in this case, a baby death, or there's another one I'm working on that's a broken wrist, broken femur, they say, oh, sorry, we can't talk about it, it's all confidential. When you guys ask them, sorry, I can't talk about it confidential. That's bull crap. So there needs to be some accountability. So I asked the county exec to get involved. I'm asking this committee to get involved. I'm going to be presenting this committee and the whole county board and the whole county with all of my evidence and the police reports. Because a lot of times what's good is that the police reports references the DCFS reports. So even though they keep them secret and won't dare talk about the mistakes they made, we can get a little window into the mistakes that DCFS has made. A lot of you at this table have seen those terrible pictures of those houses where these kids are living in, and these two guys said, whatever, it's okay. Maybe they didn't know about that. Maybe it was one of their staff members, but they know now. They've both seen them. They've both been to my website, I can promise you that. They've seen those pictures. And they're going to try to pass out this thing and say, there's only a certain amount of things we can do, and you know we have low staff, they're underpaid. But in these conditions, they were notified of them and decided not to take action retroactively. So don't let them fool you. I think you guys are bright enough not to be boondoggled here at this committee. But the organization is broken, I can tell you firsthand. And I know there's some great people on this committee that will take what I bring to you and what you've seen seriously and see what you can't do to make improvements. And again, mistakes are going to happen, but what's important is that people that make those mistakes get corrected and they don't happen again, hopefully, at all. But yeah, a child died because of staff for DCFS that decided, oh, weed is okay because it's legal in Illinois. We can let parents smoke weed. And then those parents got stoned and smothered a kid. And these guys don't care. But I know you will. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other public comment? You just state your name and address for the record, please.
Michelle Marshall, 6116 82nd Avenue, Kenosha, Wisconsin. I too just wanted to share, as a mandatory reporter in the community, I think in the onset of my career, it's like, oh, we have this cavalry. It was great, like cavalry. If we see something, we say something, we report it. And then I think the system is overwhelmed, but B, in that transparency, there does need to be a level of confidentiality with child records. Like, I definitely think that there are things that happen, like to very young people, that again, like only certain individuals should be privileged to. So that's an important like consideration in how things are communicated. But the follow-up from the person who reports to then who takes the baton and then to find out like what happens, there's no communication. And so when you report and then you see the same things going on and the same kid like having the same things happen and not really understanding like the full measure of intervention that's happened, it lends itself to these narratives that the system maybe isn't doing anything. And so I don't know like necessarily how like there can be a better communication loop between the people who are advocating for kids and then the actions that are taken. But I think that that would go a long way to examining like how certain things can be avoided. I've also just kind of noticed like in the course of the different roles that I've had, in one particular instance, I was working in a school district and there was a child that was being human trafficked, okay? So initially, like they didn't realize that there was an older sibling. And so the older sibling almost went home. So then we figured that out and like grabbed the child off the bus. And then we and the social workers on campus had asked for the bail to be set like for the mother quite high because we were worried that if she was released that she would just take the children and we would never see them again. And that is exactly what happened. And so it seems as though DCFS and the police department work in isolated cells. And I'm not sure like because there's so much need, like how often they get a chance to collaborate like on different things and then help one another like in some of these stories and narratives, like make decisions that protect kids better. In another instance, when I was working out in the county, we were trying to look at like how to expand how we could support families and what we wanted to see our school community, like draw them into like our school community to become more engaged. And there wasn't a whole lot that we had like in the county. And so Kenosha was having these meetings for parents led by Gary Vargas, and he's amazing. This gentleman walks on water. And so as a parent of children in Kenosha Unified, like I decided to go to the meeting and then talk about what this might look like west of the eye. And I'm sitting in this room and I'm listening to this mother who had just come to the community. She was escaping domestic violence had a lot of things going on with her children at the hands of the trauma that they had experienced. Crying, was working at Payless. Payless was closing. So been totally cut off by her family because of the abuser, was in hiding and was about to be unemployed. And Mr. Vargas was like, call the churches. Like that was his response in terms of like the Calvary coming to like support this person, not like our local institutions. I think that's a problem. I think that was really telling and like who is seen as resourceful. So I met the mother at Panera and drove, she drove behind me to the job center on my birthday so that she would know like how she could get connected to community avenues. And so I think that there's a great structure, and yet like if they could just work more effectively with some of the other counterparts for the overwhelming amount of work, then we could be gelling, and a lot of these things wouldn't fall through the cracks the way that they have, and tragedies could be avoided, and more people could be channeled into the supports that are there by being made aware of them. But there's no connective tissue or glue.
Thank you. Any additional public comment? Any additional public comment? Seeing none, public comment is closed. Next on the agenda are our chairman's comments. I would like to express my condolences to Dr. Freiheit. She lost her mother recently, and that is why the agenda does not have her presentation on it tonight, as was planned. We would like to hear the data that was going to be provided in that presentation, possibly sometime before the year. And Mr. Jansen and I are working on possibly scheduling, her availability permitting, maybe a special meeting in which we can have that data presented. So stay tuned for more information on that. Any supervisor comments? Any member comments?
I just want to remind the committee that WCA has a health equity webinar Monday between 9 and 10:30. So I think we all got emailed on that, so we can all log in and hear the WCA report on health equity.
We were Supervisor Gearson and I were speaking offline about how it was important to tie that presentation in with Jen's presentation. So hopefully we can work something out, and sure, and we can get those done maybe in the same week or two.
Sure.
Any other comments from committee members? Supervisors in the room? Youth and Governance? Seeing none, we'll move on. I need a motion for the approval of the minutes from the October 4th, 2022 meeting.
I would move approval of all the minutes.
Second.
I just want to comment on the work that was done with all of the budget reports and everything. That was a
lot
of work.
Are you moving to approve all the minutes?
To move all the minutes, yeah, if that's okay.
So motion to approve minutes from October 4 and October 19, 2022.
Right, to approve all the minutes, right. And thank you for all the work that was done. They looked good. So.
Who was the second? Thank you. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Minutes are approved. Next, we have a resolution to approve the appointment of Mrs. Julie Bales to serve on the Kenosha County Commission on Aging and Disability Services.
Ms. Bales is with us tonight, so if you have questions, I'm sure she'd be happy to answer any. We are really excited to have the two that are up for appointment today for the Commission on Aging and Disability Services. Julie comes as a patient advocate. She's also been a caregiver for multiple family members, as well as a child with disabilities who's not an adult. She understands the long-term care system, having worked within the system, so I really think she's going to have and bring a lot of positive energy and ideas to our committee, so I really hope that you consider her for appointment. Thank you.
Are there any questions for Julie? What's your experience in the long-term care business?
So as many of you maybe in this room, I found myself in a sandwich generation, caring full-time for children at home as well as aging parents. And then I found myself a step further as my seven-year-old developed a very rare disease, which requires us going out of state for all of his medical care, and resulted in him being permanently disabled. So I was really new to advocating and being a voice for him, obtaining services, Social Security disability, and I found my calling. I found just the small victories are just so huge when we can take a problem or something that is unseen or maybe not recognized or maybe misunderstood, and turn it around and make it a positive. So that's my hope. I'm really honored, and I just want to serve and, give those most deserving adults an opportunity to be seen in the community. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Do I have a motion to approve?
I would move approval.
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you. Motion passes. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Resolution to approve the appointment of Mr. Brian Hopkins to serve in the Kenosha County Commission on Aging and Disability Services.
And Mr. Hopkins is also available tonight for us. Again, very excited to have him aboard. Mr. Hopkins serves as a special education teacher for the Wilmot School District. He works with youth that are transitioning into adulthood, which is a core task that the Aging and Disability Resource Center does, making sure that those children receive adult services when they become the age that they transition out of youth services. So he's also going to bring a new dynamic that we've not had on the Commission on Aging and Disability Services before, and I think that his input is going to be it's going to be needed and very valuable, and we really look forward to him. So I please hope that you will pass him through. Thank you very much.
Thanks for being here. Did you want to add anything to that?
Thank you for that. I am our special ed coordinator at Wilmot High School, and so I do a lot of transition work. I had the privilege 5 years ago of starting at Wilmot High School as a special ed teacher and starting in and identifying some needs we had in our school district for adults with disabilities. And our at the time superintendent and director of special ed tasked me with starting a transition program. So I was able to build contacts throughout the state and in Illinois and have since was able to build a transition program that fit in the county, and have since expanded my professional network with presenting across the Midwest and the state of Wisconsin of kind of what we're doing at Wilmot High School. And so, a lot of the areas and needs that we have, I think, are areas that other schools might have as well. So I'm excited to kind of be a voice for some of those on the commission.
Thank you for all that you do, and thank you for volunteering. Is there any other questions? A motion to approve?
Move approval.
Second.
Motion by Supervisor Geertsen to approve, second by Supervisor Stocker. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Number 8 on the agenda, resolution for the appointment of Mr. Donald Deal to serve on the Veterans Services Commission.
Thank you. Mr. Deal is here this evening in case anyone has any questions. He'd be a new appointment to the commission. He's actively involved in American Legion and participates in a number of other veteran-related events, and we'd ask your support for his appointment to the commission. If you have any questions, he's right here.
Johnny, anything you want to say?
Chairman, committee members, I want to first thank you for considering my appointment to the Veterans Services Commission. It's an important commission. Veterans are important to me. As the first vice commander of the Legion Post 21, I've become more aware of issues that a lot of the veterans face. And I'm looking forward to working with the current commission members and helping be a part of providing those emergency services and other benefits to those veterans that are in need. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Deal? Seeing none, do I have a motion to approve? Motion
second.
To approve by Supervisor Stock, second by Supervisor Geertsen. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Number 9, resolution for the reappointment of Mr. Charles Burmeister to serve on the Veterans Services Commission.
Thank you. Mr. Burmeister, as you pointed out, is a reappointment. He's attended all of the meetings in his past appointment. He is a member of several veterans organizations and active on the commission. We'd ask for his reappointment, which would run through 2025.
Any discussion? Questions?
Move to approve.
Second.
Motion to approve by Supervisor Kubicki, second by Supervisor Juhas. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Number 10, resolution to approve the reappointment of Mrs. Pauline Lorenz to serve on the Kenosha County Commission on Aging and Disability Services.
So Ms. Lorenz has been serving for the last year. She took over a slot of a person that had to leave our board. She works as an independent living advocate in the community, so she's very tied into the community that we serve. She has missed one meeting in her term, and that was due to illness, which was certainly excused. So I hope that you consider her for appointment. Thank you.
Any questions? Discussion? Is there a motion to approve?
Motion to approve Pauline Lorenz.
Second.
Motion to approve by Supervisor Juhas with a second from Supervisor Kubicki. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Resolution to approve the reappointment of Ms. Julie Freeze to serve on the Kenosha County Commission on Aging and Disability Services.
So Julie has also served for the past year. She was also someone that took over for another board member who had to leave. Julie represents our aging community. That's what she serves on our board as. She has missed two meetings, although one of them was a hiccup that we had with technology that she was supposed to attend virtually, and the other one she was also sick on. So she does bring a lot. She's very vocal. She brings a lot of attention to the matters that we are important to us. So I hope that you are willing to reappoint her. Thank you.
I have a question, Rebecca. Are you still meeting virtually?
No. We offer it as an option for people who are not committee members, so like the community that would like to attend. We still have some older citizens that don't feel comfortable coming into the building, so we want to make sure that they're able to attend if they'd like. But our committee members need to be present in order to have a vote.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks for clarifying.
Sure.
Any other questions or discussion? Do I have a motion to approve?
Move approval.
Approval moved by Supervisor Geertsen.
Second.
Second by Supervisor Stock. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Resolution for the reappointment of Gabe Nudo to serve on the Brookside Board of Trustees.
Thank you. This is a request to reappoint Chairman Nudo to the Brookside Board of Trustees. Since he's been on there, he's been an active member attending meetings, and this would run through January 5th, 2026. He is here if you have questions.
Chairman Nudo, anything you want to say about the Brookside Board?
Well, I don't know. John said it all, so.
Okay. Any other questions for Chairman Nudo? Is there a motion to approve?
Move approval.
Approval moved by Supervisor Geertsen.
Second.
Seconded by Supervisor Stock. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. 13, presentation on policies and procedures relating to child abuse or neglect investigations. Ron Rogers, Director of Division of Children and Family Services. Welcome.
Good evening. Thank you for letting me speak with you tonight. You received two documents. One is a child welfare report. We're not going to go through that. That's really background information for the presentation. It's sort of a snapshot of all the work we did in 2021. So there's a lot of detail in that report, but we're really going to focus today on the PowerPoint that was sent to you, and you've given a paper copy that was stapled together. So really, this is done to just give you the facts about how the division is run and how we do our work in the Division of Children and Family Services. So with that said, we'll go to the next slide. And so CPS is a specialized field of child welfare. Our authority comes from Chapter 48 of Wisconsin Statutes, the Children's Code. And the Children's Code then directs the Department of Children and Families to establish standards that all counties must follow. So Wisconsin is one of the states where the state supervises our work, but the counties do the child protective services work. So if we do the next slide, please. So these are the three standards that govern our work. Kenosha County follows all three of these. The Child Protective Service Safety Intervention Standards, they're the overarching theme of our work to assess for child safety from the moment we receive a phone call until we do the investigation. And if those cases need to come into the system, we're following those standards throughout the life of a case. The Child Protective Services Access and Initial Assessment Standards then guide how we take in the calls of abuse and neglect and how we conduct the investigations, which are called initial assessments. And the Wisconsin Ongoing Service Standards then guide us how we do that work with the families. If we go to the next slide, please. So access is required to receive calls 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The state dictates, the reason we take those phone calls is we have to gather a lot of information from the reporters on the makeup of the family, what is the alleged maltreatment, who's living in the home. Primarily, we're investigating families where there's allegations that a child or children are maltreated. We also will investigate other areas, such as kids in a camp or a childcare provider, a teacher, someone who has control or care of a child, responsible care. As a general rule of thumb, none of the counties investigate abuse to a child by a non-family member that doesn't have a caretaker responsibility. So, for example, when you see these stories on the internet about some creep, some man who's luring children, he's not related to the children. When we get calls like that, we refer all those calls to law enforcement. They're documented in our state system, but because that person's not related to the child, we're not going to investigate that. That is really just a law enforcement issue, okay? Next slide, if we can, please. So we talk about child safety, and the state that guides us through ACCESS, which is when people are calling to report abuse, neglect, initial assessment, ongoing services, the state defines two different kinds of danger threats to children. Present danger, meaning it's immediate, it's happening right now, it's probably severe, it's significant. Examples of this are calls that come in where people are reporting young children with multiple injuries to their head, multiple injuries to different parts of their body, and no one's giving a clear explanation. So the kid that walks into the school with a black eye and a bruise on their arm and maybe another mark somewhere else, and the teacher asks what happened, and the kid doesn't really give an answer, doesn't, you know, sort of mumble something, so there's no clear anything logical that the teacher would then call us to report that, okay? That's a present danger. Present, the reason we assess that when the phone calls come in, because if someone's reporting present danger, then we will go out that day to see that child. Impending danger is a little deeper level. It's really, you have to actually know the family a little better, but it's conditions in the home that most people would believe could lead to a child being in danger of being maltreated. So for example, no adult in the home is performing parental duties or responsibilities. One of the parents has an impulsive behavior they cannot or will not control. So that is a big sentence that's saying a parent that has a drug addiction or a substance abuse issue or alcoholism, and they're not controlling that, not taking care of their kids. So those are assigned a response time of 24 to 48 hours. And then if no one's calling in, and they're not identifying present or impending danger, and there's a greater list than what I've given you verbally of both of those, then they're assigned a 5-day response time, okay? And so if you go to the next slide, this is the key part of the work we do. So the state statute identifies, and the standards identify, what we can investigate and what we cannot. And if you go to the next slide, the state is very clear that if there is not real maltreatment being described in the report, or if someone's calling in just inappropriate parenting, like parenting that maybe nobody in this room would ever do with their own children, but it's not unsafe or it's not injuring a child, we're not allowed to investigate that. We're not allowed to conduct an initial assessment. It's actually in the standards. There are constitutional protections against unjustified interventions in family life. So what they're saying by that is when you open the door to do an initial assessment, you are also saying that we can contact a child's pediatrician, we can contact the school, we can get other collateral information on a child without the parent's permission. So that's the key. It has to reach a standard of maltreatment that the state sets before we can launch an initial assessment. So if you go to the next slide, so what this looks like, and this slide in our county, people are always shocked about this when they first look at it, but this is very common across the entire state. We get a lot of phone calls. We get calls about almost everything. We have to document every phone call. If we get a call about abuse and neglect from one teacher and another teacher in the school reports the same abuse and neglect, we record both of those as Child Protective Service reports. We're going to screen one in, but the other one's going to be screened out as a multiple referral on the same incident. Or we also are called on every sexual contact between teenagers, because it is against the law for kids to have sex with each other, a 16 and a 17-year-old, boyfriend, girlfriend. People will call that in. We will not investigate that, none of the counties do, but we will send that referral to law enforcement because kids are not legally allowed to have sexual contact with one another. So that we get a lot of calls in all those areas. So what people really want to know is, when we make a screening decision to screen cases in, we're following the state standards, and what you can see from this chart is that 2021 was a very busy year of doing initial assessments. 2020 was a very low year. That was in the heart of COVID. So if you think about that, the schools were shut down. Who is our biggest referral source for child abuse and neglect? Schools. Second are medical providers and daycare providers. So we completed 894 initial assessments in 2021. If you go to the next slide, what that looks like. So we screened in 31% of the calls we got. The state as a whole that same year screened in almost the exact same percentage, about 31%. So what that is telling you is that we're following the state standards that the whole state of Wisconsin is following. And what I teased out of this graph is I took out Milwaukee County because there's such extreme poverty there. And they have a whole section of the city that really lives in a very poor manner, and there's a lot of concerns of how children are cared for in that area. So if you take that out of their percentage, we screen in we screen in more cases than the state as a whole. They screen in at 28%. So if we can go to the next slide. So what we said before, as I said before, when those calls come in, we're then we're setting a response time, and then we send a worker out to do what we used to call an investigation, and now we call it an initial assessment, because it's much bigger than simply looking to see if there's a bruise or a mark on a child. We actually have to interview everybody in that home and see everybody in that home. So if we can go to the next slide. So this is every time we screen in a case where the allegation is abuse and neglect occurring and the alleged maltreater is an adult that is caring for those children, we're interviewing the alleged victim or victims. If they're younger children, we absolutely are seeing those children. We're interviewing siblings and any other children in the home. So if you have a blended family, where we have two families living together for whatever reason, we're going to interview every child in that home. We're going to interview every adult in that home, meaning not just the parent, not just the mother or the father, but if there's a grandma, grandpa living in the home, an aunt and uncle, we're going to interview them. We will absolutely interview the alleged maltreater or maltreaters. I mentioned all the adults, and we'll make other collateral contacts depending on at least one, and many times more than one, depending on the allegation of abuse and the age of the children. So for example, if it's an allegation of neglect and it's a very dirty home, we're going to be contacting probably the pediatricians of the children, neighbors, other family members, to get a sense of how long has the home been in this condition, what is occurring in that home. We will always go to the home where the alleged abuse has occurred. And we prefer to go more than once. And when we go to that home, we're looking for safety threats, meaning the actual physical condition of the home. Is there unsafe wiring? Is there running water? Is there safe plumbing? You know, is there garbage strewn about the place? All of those things. And as we're doing that work, we're assessing safety and using, I gave you just very brief examples of our safety standards, but we're looking at all of the safety standards and making a determination if kids are unsafe. So we go to the next slide. So what are we gathering? So what we're doing in this initial assessment is we're gathering information about alleged maltreatment and surrounding circumstances, child functioning, meaning how is each child functioning in the home? If they're infants or toddlers, are they at their developmental milestones? Do they show delays? Are they in programs like for birth to three? If they're school age kids, are they in regular education or maybe in special education? How are they doing in school? Are they, you know, are the parents reporting they're doing well? How does the adult function in their life? What are, you know, do they have a job? Do they seem depressed? Do they seem to have any issues like drug abuse, mental health issues, any substance abuse issues? What are their parenting practices? Not just discipline, but what is the routine of parenting in this home? If there are two parents in the home, how do they co-parent together? And then just the family functioning in general. How is this family functioning? Do they keep a roof over their head? Is there money coming into the home? Are they a family that seems to be transient? They don't seem to have stable housing. What does the home look like? How is the home, you know, are they keeping the home up? We're gathering all that information. The state also makes sure we have to document if we have, if anyone in the home has Indian heritage, American Indian heritage. And then if often we are running into homes where every child has two parents, but the children reside primarily with one parent. So we're getting information on the non-custodial parent. And we're trying to contact the non-custodial parent. And if we make effort to reach them and get their impression of how the custodial parent is parenting. So we go to the next slide. So we gather all that and we create what we call an initial assessment. It's an 8 to 12 page document that lists, that describes all those things I just described for you. It lists it in a report. And during that process, our social workers are being supervised by a supervisor. They're sharing that case information with the supervisor. They're, if they're running into problems, they're getting advice or direction or guidance. And at the end of that initial assessment, they're trying to answer all those bullets that are listed on this slide. So first, is the child unsafe? Is the child in need of protection or services? Do we need to do court intervention? What are the threats to child safety and how can we control them? If there are mild threats to child safety, we can do something called an in-home safety plan, where we don't have to remove children from their home. We have services that can literally be in a home 7 days a week, multiple times during the week, at safety risk times. So we can do that. Or are safety threats so severe that children need to be removed from that home? The next thing is if we do identify safety threats, are the parents able to control those? So using my example earlier, a parent that is has a substance abuse issue, if they're the only parent in the home and there's not another parent, how will they, if that substance abuse issue probably will impact their ability to parent a child, to safely care for a child. A two-parent home where one parent is clean and sober and one parent is abusing drugs or alcohol may be able to have a safe home for the child. That's all part of that assessment. We want to then look to see if the child is unsafe, if the child was maltreated, and we make a formal determination, did maltreatment occur, and who's the maltreater, and that's documented in the case record. The vast majority of cases that we investigate do not need court intervention, but we have families that have issues and needs. And we have an arm of the division called the Prevention Services Network. So if kids are not unsafe, if kids are safe, but this is a family that has some needs, we refer them to community-based services. we refer them to our Prevention Services Network. There's information in the report about that network. That's not in the slide presentation I'm going over this evening. Mm-hmm. We can go forward again. So, one of the marks of doing good work is, do you get your work done on time? Is it complete and is it thorough? Are we doing accurate, thorough initial assessments? So the state expects those initial assessments to be fully documented with all case notes, conclusions approved by a supervisor within 60 days. That chart, timeliness of initial assessment, shows how the state of Wisconsin does as a whole and how we do in comparison. The blue bar shows that we are historically at 96-97% getting that work done timely. 2021, we had one of the highest number of initial assessments we've ever done, and we had staff shortages with COVID. We had people who left employment because they no longer wanted to do that work with the COVID environment. So you put those two together, our stats dropped a little bit. In initial contact, we see every family. We will see every child in the home. We will not see a family. That statistic is, did we make that time frame that we set when the phone call came in? Did we get out there and did we make contact in 24 or 48 hours or 5 days? So we normally are in the 93%, 92%, better than the state as a whole. Last in 2021, we were only at 86 for the same reason I just shared with you. This year, we're averaging back at 92%, which I knew we would. We'd get back to that. If we can go to the next slide. So then one person asked me, okay, you do well compared to the state as a whole. And one of the judges asked me this. How do we look compared to other big counties in the state? Isn't the reason the state numbers are so bad is that Milwaukee County drags down the whole state in those two measurements. So here are the 8 busiest counties in the state for child welfare work. We're one of the 8, probably the 8th. So our statistics measure up great as far as our timeliness of getting work done, our timeliness of initial contact, much better than Racine to our north, much better than Rock County, better than Brown or Dane County. Milwaukee is really hugely larger than us, so it's unfair to really compare yourselves to Milwaukee. Winnebago is the one large county that in 2021 did slightly better in the initial contact. But those are true numbers. These are from all our state reports that the state tracks all this data. So that's just to give you a comparison. You will find some little counties in the state that get this work done at 95 to 100%. There's like Jefferson County. So the difference in that is we do 60 or more initial assessments every month. A Jefferson County does 12 in a month. I mean, they're really radically different system. We can go to the next slide, please. So then the question is, when kids are unsafe, how do kids end up in foster care? So I'm going to share a statistic with you. In 2021, out of the 895 families we touched, 70 families needed to go into the juvenile court system for a court order, and those 70 families, almost all of them had their kids placed in foster care. We'll talk more about how many kids that was in a couple more slides. And so how does that happen? So those first two columns talk about what I've already shared with you, getting the access report, conducting the initial assessment. So the third column, DCF determines children are unsafe at home. We can't do an in-home safety plan. We contact juvenile court intake services. That's our partner. They have the authority in this county to grant an emergency temporary physical custody order that allows us to place children away from their parents and into either foster care or placement with a relative or another fit adult. So that's significant. That's a legal process. We are doing, you have to get authority from the courts to take children away from their parents, even if the parents are not the best parents. And you know, so if you think the parents, so you have to present facts to JCI, they then grant the authority to do that. If you go to the next slide, The very next business day, we're in court, where we're going over those same facts to the court commissioner, and we are making the argument that these children should not be returned home, that the home is unsafe. We're presenting our factual reasons for that. We're sending information to the district attorney's office. They're drafting a petition. And often that's happening within the first few days of the initial assessment. Often those safety threats that are that apparent are showing up within the first 2 or 3 days, sometimes the first week. But there's still the rest of that initial assessment we're going to complete to get the full picture of the family. Then once this case gets into court, that middle column shows you all the people that are at court hearings going forward. The parents are there. Each parent has an attorney, the DCFS social worker, the assistant district attorney is there. Younger children have guardian ad litems. Older children have defense counsel from the public defender's office. Foster parents are invited to attend. Many choose not to, but they are always invited to attend. And all the parties, the judge runs the court commissioner or the judge runs the court hearing and really determines who's going to speak and what information is going to be shared. That continues, that process continues. And in this time, as this process is occurring, within a few days of us making a determination that these children need court protection, we have already notified the ongoing services unit. A social worker is given a secondary assignment from that unit and is starting to team with the initial assessment worker to learn about this family. And after the initial assessment worker finishes their initial assessment, there's a formal staffing where they present the case to the ongoing worker with the ongoing worker's supervisor, and they give them their view of why the kids are unsafe, what are the safety threats, what are the underlying problems that this family has that's making kids unsafe. We can flip to the next slide. So during that process, this can sometimes take 2 to 3 months. Eventually, the court is going to find that these are children in need of protection or services. And this is where the lion's share of our work with these 70 families happens. It's in the ongoing services unit. They're going to take an even deeper dive to try to figure out what's going on that makes these kids unsafe. Are parents just very young, inexperienced, and they lack basic parenting knowledge? Do they have a substance abuse issue? Do they seem to have, really, are they not functioning clearly? When we speak with them, are they not tracking what we're saying? Do we need to get a psychological evaluation for those parents? Do we need an alcohol and other drug abuse assessment or counseling? If we have a history of drug use, we're dropping urine analysis. We put them on a color, and they have to call in every day of the week, Monday through Friday, to see if their color comes up. And if their color comes up, they have to come in and give a urine sample. We spend over $100,000 a year doing urine testing in Kenosha County. That's roughly the same amount for years now. That's how much work there is in that. We provide these services for the family. The ongoing social worker has created a case plan. It's called a permanency plan for each child in the home. And so in that second column, you're seeing all the work that's going in for each child in the family. So for a single child, two children, three children, we're looking, do they've been in a home where abuse and neglect has occurred? Do they need therapy? Do they need family therapy? Are there developmental delays? Do they have any other special needs? We're getting all those services in place for those kids as we're providing services for the parents. And as it says in red there, there's certain kids that have come through being abused and neglected where they need even a more stronger supportive placement setting because a regular foster home is not supportive enough. And so then we look at treatment foster care or a residential care center. Group home is usually used for more teenage kids. It's not for younger kids. So this continues, and this continues. This work is a lot of work. And so once kids come into the child welfare system and they're placed on an order and they're placed in foster care, the judge orders that the order goes until they're 18 or 19 years old. and the court reviews that every 6 months. So we'll go to the next slide. And so what that means is the court doesn't just give us these kids and say, okay, you know, come back to us when you think you're done. Every 6 months, we're back in court preparing a formal report to the court called a permanency plan for each child in care. The permanency plan is, think of it like a case plan. It lists all the services provided for that child and the services provided for that mother. So if a mother has three children, then we're doing three permanency plans. Those hearings involve everybody that was in that earlier slide, the parents, defense counsel. We work with many mothers that have children maybe with two different fathers, so both fathers will be at that hearing. Both fathers will have defense counsel. We're working with those fathers as well, providing services for them, trying to see which parent can make some changes so they can become the safe parent to parent these children. Now, this slide also talks about if parents are making progress. So when the CHIPS order, if CHIPS stands for Children in Need of Protection or Services, is ordered by the court, when the children are found to be in need of protection or services, the judge also orders what they call conditions of return. Because we've prepared a report to the court saying, when we took that deeper dive, Your Honor, these are the salient, the most important things that parent needs to change to be a safe parent. The judge orders that. So if it's a judge that says, you know, you have a drug abuse issue, then you need to go to therapy. You need to show that you're sober. You need to show us that you have, and we measure that by clean urine analysis, that the parents are actually going to therapy, that the therapist is telling us they're making progress. We also, parents are visiting their kids all the time this is going on, so we have notes from people that are supervising those visits, and we're seeing how they parent their kids. And as parents make progress, then we present that to the court during these permanency plans. And if we're making progress, the court then decides, do we have discretion to increase visits? Can we move from supervised visits to monitored visits? And we have great services that parents can start to visit their kids in their own home, where people can drop in unannounced, unexpectedly, and check in on how are these visits going? Is everyone safe? And report back to the social worker. Progress happens, but it doesn't happen quickly. It is very often that families are in the ongoing services unit well over a year. 2 years is common, but they may not be in foster care for 2 years, because if they're making progress, then we present that to the court, and all of those same parties weigh in on that decision, meaning the district attorney, the guardian ad litem, the parent's attorney, our staff, and foster parents, if they choose to show up to the hearing. And at that time, if the judge orders the children back home, they never just drop them off at home, and we don't close our case then. They order what they call an order of continuing case management and supervision of those children in the home, and that's what that last column says. And we request, on average, a 12-month order. They can't order longer than 12 months, but we request that because we want to stay involved with the family. We want to keep supporting the changes that were made. And to be very frank, we want to make sure the changes are real, that they're not, that someone isn't just been complying and not really making real change. So we continue to manage that case for 12 months. And if the parents are doing well, they don't come back to court during those 12 months. We're running that case. But if things aren't going well, we still have an order, and we can bring them back to court and have the judge speak with them again, or we can file a change of placement to have those kids removed from the parents' home if things aren't going well, because we still have authority.
If children are sent back home to their parents in this entire process,
yes,
and you have to remove them again, is that are you starting all over again with the removal process?
No, there's an order in place. So it's a different process. What you want to do is you don't want to wait for a child to be harmed again.
Okay.
Right. So what you're looking for is you would present to the court. It's not always an instantaneous, but you schedule a hearing and you present to the court the evidence why the kids need to be taken out of the home.
It's not as difficult the second time around if we're still in that period of time where there's orders.
And there's another thing called a trial reunification, where you can if you can have kids return home on a trial reunification. This is very technical now, where it's still on an out-of-home care order. And so if in those cases, we have a lot of discretion just to move kids back into foster care without even waiting for a hearing. And we use that. And that's talked about in the child welfare report. At least it gives you some stats about it. Can you go one more slide? And then what I really wanted, I won't spend a lot of time on this. This came up, I think, during the budget process. So what happens when families are not making progress, parents? And so during our permanency plans that we're doing in court every 6 months, we have to put down a permanency goal. It usually starts with reunification. But if at the six-month permanency plan, the parents are just floundering, nothing is happening, we will go in for a dual goal. They call it concurrent planning. And we will often ask for reunification and adoption. And it's sort of like doing two things at once. You are going to still provide all the services you can to that family with the hope that parent makes changes to become a safe parent. At the same time, that social worker is trying to figure out if this parent cannot be the safe parent and the other parent, who maybe was not the primary custodian, cannot be the safe parent. Maybe that other parent's incarcerated in prison for the next 6 years or something, then who can be? And that's where we start to look at relatives as adoptive resources or the foster parents that are caring for those kids currently. And that's where we have these discussions with the foster parents. Would you ever consider being an adoptive resource? That can start at the six-month mark. If parents are really floundering, the judge has to order both those permanency goals. Some of judges don't like to order a concurrent goal at 6 months, but at a year, if the parents aren't making any progress, almost all the judges, both judges will always order a concurrent goal. So then, if the parents still continue to flounder and not making any progress, while we're still offering all this help, we prepare documentation for termination of parental rights. We work with our partners in the district attorney's office. They draft a petition. And another whole court process starts. And it's called termination of parental rights. So if you think about that, that's a very significant court hearing. You're saying these parents will no longer be the legal parents of their children. They will no longer have any rights to their children. That is a whole separate court process that often takes months to finalize. But as a general rule, once we've made that decision, once we are not seeing any progress by the parents, those go forward. And the court determines that there are grounds exist to terminate parental rights and that it's the best interest of the child to terminate those rights. And the court orders that. And then what's unusual with Wisconsin is at that point our work ends and the case literally gets transferred. Each child, so if it's a three-child family, we're terminating parental rights on all three children. Each child is transferred to the state of Wisconsin and assigned a state worker who completes the adoption, which is another court process. And we hear about that, and we can track. And many of our workers like to attend those hearings because they want to see they want to just see it wrap up, you know, because they often know they usually know the adoptive resources because the adoptive resources are the people that have been caring for those children over the last 2 years. Well over 90% of all the adoption in the child welfare system are adopted by the relative caregiver or foster parent that's been caring for the child. It's very rare that it changes. Yeah.
You said what's unique about Wisconsin. Is there something
other states sometimes keep that work. They may keep it through adoption. And so I think what's unique about Wisconsin is that we transfer the case, you know, and a new social worker who doesn't know the family finalizes the adoption.
having been in this business for a long time, do you think that Wisconsin does, the Wisconsin process is efficient and in the best interest of the child, or?
That's a great question. I think everybody, if the state gave us additional resources to finish that work at the local county level, I think we would love to finish that work. But it would take some more resources because
But in terms of the best interest of the child.
Yeah, for the interest of the child.
All of a sudden they have to start with a whole new group of people.
Yeah. I think it would help the foster parent too. Because we've got the relationship with the foster parent. The state worker does not. I don't know that historically why Wisconsin organized it that way. I think it had to do more with money, that they take over the cost of foster care at that time, and so they assign their worker to manage the case, is my guess. Because when kids are in foster care, we are paying that foster payment. Once the TPR occurs, the state picks up the cost of that care. And then kids that are in the child welfare system, when they're adopted, adoptive parents get a stipend every month that is similar to the foster care reimbursement if the children have qualified for that, and the majority do.
How does a child qualify for that?
They have to have a lot of significant needs in many areas. And I don't mean necessarily that they're a special needs child, like with a disability, but they've experienced trauma. They have some needs in their parenting. Many of the kids have experienced such trauma that they do have significant special needs in school or high school. And there's a whole assessment scale called the Child Adolescent Needs Strengths Assessment Scale, CANS, CANS. And they score high on that, frankly. Yeah. One more slide, if you can. So the good news in all of this is when you looked at 2021, we completed initial assessments on 894 families. Some of those families were referred for voluntary prevention services. 70, less than 10%, needed formal court intervention. And if you go to the next slide, what does that look like in the ongoing unit? So this is a tough slide to read, but if you can just bear with me, we'll look at the year 2021. So those 70 families that came into the ongoing unit, there were 113 children in those homes spread out. The ongoing unit also gets some other work assigned to it. We get interstate compact for children cases. People move to Wisconsin. There's a whole process when families move from one state to another. So that's additional work that unit gets. So they work with a total of 278 families in 2021, 494 children. They started the year this year with 170 families open, 309 children. That's because we talked about during our budget presentation about project permanency and finding permanent safe homes for kids. So we're getting kids to permanent safe homes. And if we can go to the next slide, this just gives you a snapshot again for 2021, not for termination of parental rights, but actually completed adoptions. So we tend to lead the state in the percentage of kids. Of all, 204 children achieved legal permanence in Kenosha County in 2021. 68% of those achieved legal permanence through reunification. The next group we always strive for is adoption, which is 27% of the children. You can compare that to the state of Wisconsin. So we do a better job of reunifying kids safely, and we complete a larger percentage of kids to adoption. We don't do as much guardianship. We really save guardianship for older children. If we have younger children, we would prefer to find an adoptive resource. So we work very hard at that. That's why that number is lower. Not because there's more kids waiting for guardianship. We don't have as many guardianships. That's why they get moved to the adoption category. Next slide, if you could. Just to show you the volume of work, number of kids achieving legal permanence since 17. We started our project permanency efforts in 2019 to 2020. That's why you see that big movement of 260 children achieving permanency in 2020. We got through sort of a backlog. The 204 number is not, does not mean that we're doing worse work. It really shows you that we got through the backlog and we're doing very good work. And then to speak, one more slide if we could. So what's unique to Kenosha and what other counties don't use the way we do is we use, there's a part of Chapter 48 called, a statute called the CORE agreement, Coordinated Response to Child Abuse and Neglect, which allows multidisciplinary teams to be used to share information for the betterment of children and to keep kids safe. Everybody on this slide, all these businesses, or agencies, I should say, sign our CORE agreement. We sign it annually. And then middle management from each of these agencies attends a monthly CORE meeting. And the monthly CORE meeting is to talk about how is the system working? Are we seeing the kids that we should see? When kids go to a hospital with an injury, are they calling that into our staff? How is our work with law enforcement? Are we partnering with law enforcement? And so we have the sheriff attend these meetings, and at our monthly CORE meetings, they're called an organizational review committee, we tackle different topics. So we have a drug endangered children protocol that came out of this work. So when police go in to do a drug bust at a home and there's little kids there, they now can alert us confidentially. We can have social workers ready so that people, if we need to take those kids into care, we can do that. We have a human trafficking task force, and we just talk about how we can improve the system. A lot of counties don't do that, and they don't put any resources towards that. We do that. And we are considered a well-run child protective service county by the state of Wisconsin. The statistics I showed you are actual facts of the work we do. We continue to see every kid in foster care. We see kids that we're required to see every kid in foster care every month. We do that at a rate of 99%, and that includes the older kids. Usually when we miss a kid, it's because it's a scheduling mishap in the month and it's a teenager. We don't miss seeing little kids in foster care. Why do we do that? We want to make sure the kids are safe in foster care. If they're old enough to talk, we want to speak with the kids privately. We want to talk to the foster parents and make sure they're getting the support they need. That's a stat that almost none of the other counties there, you know, the state as a whole does that at about 97%. You know, we pride ourselves in that. And we really appreciate the support of this committee and the county board, because we have a lot of services that this presentation today did not go over that work when we are reunifying kids in a family home, that are able to check on parents, check on those kids, and provide services in those homes to make sure kids are safe. And we even have one program called our Intensive Aftercare Reunification Program, which literally can check on kids twice a day, 7 days a week in parents' homes as we're assessing to see if the children are making a safe transition there. So I'd be happy, I know we're running late on time, I know you have a county board meeting, but I'm happy to answer some questions if you'd like, if you have any questions for me.
Churches should be included on that.
So I had a number of questions that I was writing down as we went. I think that one of the things that prompted the agenda topic tonight was some stories circulating in local news lately, and maybe if you could maybe give us your perspective on how things maybe slip through the cracks sometimes.
Well, there's an old story that Mr. Matheson shared when he came to sitting in this chair, where he had photos of a very deplorable home. And so again, we're bound by Chapter 48 that I can't give case details on a specific case or even share what cases we've worked with. But I can share this general statement. We are not law enforcement. We engage families. So if we had a family that has a deplorable home, we will try to see those kids first in a school setting. We will then go out to that home. Depending on if that parent is at the home and they are saying to us, you are not allowed in, we are not going to let you in my home for whatever reason, and they are leaving the community, we have to have an emergent reason to call law enforcement to say, we need to go in that home right now, today. Our normal way of working would be to say to that parent, well, what's going on now? I need to come into your home. I need to see your home. Can I come back tomorrow? Can I come back the next day? And we work with that. If that family then leaves jurisdiction, literally leaves, we will never get in that home. Now, law enforcement has authorities that we do not have. So if we walk to a home and we knock on the door and their little kid answers the door and there are no adults in that home, and like a toddler, we're not gonna drive back to the office and say, oh, we'll try tomorrow. We're gonna get on our cell phone, we're gonna call law enforcement right then and there and say, we're at this home, there's a little kid here, we don't think there's any adults here, can you meet us at the home? They're gonna show up on the spot. They then have the authority to make a decision if they can go in that home. And so what is being described is when news stories circulate on old news is only part of a story. And what we are also mandated reporters, and we are part of the larger child welfare system, meaning the state as a whole is a child welfare system. So families that are living in deplorable conditions and we find out about it and they move to another county, we will contact that other county and give them all that information. And then that other county will then have to make the social work response. So the difference between law enforcement and social workers is we're both looking to protect kids from abuse and neglect. We both don't want to see any child harmed. We both, so we both determine if someone has harmed a child. We're determining that so we can make a case plan and figure out how to solve things so that child isn't harmed again and what services that family needs. Law enforcement is doing that to see if a crime has been committed and if it needs to be charged and taken into criminal court. So the crime is charged where the alleged crime occurred. The services have to be provided wherever the children are living. And so if families move in the middle of some initial assessment, it's where they move to that would have to work with those kids, because we don't have jurisdiction of those kids in that other setting.
Would you say that that happens frequently?
No, it's highly unusual.
For a family to just up and move?
Yeah, it's very rare. But families are families move around a lot more than they did 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. And between Racine and Kenosha, there's a lot of movement between families, live for a while in Racine, live in Kenosha. But as far as up and move quickly like that, that's very rare. It's very rare.
Okay, I'm just gonna hit a few of my key ones, yeah, and I'll let some others participate. One of our guests tonight indicated that in a situation she witnessed, it didn't seem like a family even knew DCFS existed. How does the agency make its services known to the community, and how can we do that better so that when there are families in need, yeah, who might be presenting with at-risk situations that could develop, mm-hmm, into something harmful to children, you know, how do we make sure that people know those services are there?
That's a great question. We are on, you know, we have a county website, we have our prevention services there. All the schools know, the large majority of referrals for services come through the school, right, district. So if you look at the core agreement, Kenosha Unified is a big part of that.
But that's after something's happened.
No, but they also know that these services are there. So it's not unusual for guidance counselors or social workers to make referrals directly to Prevention Services Network. They get quite a few referrals that way, or to our Families First program when there's kids with special needs. We get services that way. Yeah, so certainly there's probably other things we could do to get the word out even more.
You talked quite a bit about what's safe and what's unsafe, and I know that's probably a whole different discussion. Is there someplace or some documentation or like really specific guidelines as to where you draw the line, or do you feel that it's maybe more subjective from one?
There's a lot of, the state statute, Chapter 48, is very general. Then in the safety standards and in the initial assessment, primarily in the safety standards and appendices that the state puts out, are a lot more specific guidelines. So speaking really broadly, very broadly, for example, people who are worried about having contact with DCFS because they spank their children or discipline their children with spanking. Spanking is almost, you know, spanking of a hand on a bottom over clothing is not going to be considered abuse generally. We don't advise that. We believe there's other ways to discipline children that are more effective. But someone who still is spanking their kids, but where it crosses the line is where there's injuries. So when spanking is not a hand on a butt over clothing, but rather is a belt, and suddenly the belt is the belt buckle side of the belt hitting the kid, and those are leaving marks. That then, even though the parent thinks they're disciplining, their disciplines cross the line, and it's become abuse.
So and that's a good example on the abuse side, but in terms of like neglect or unsafe conditions, I think that there's probably
there's listing. The photos that that Mr. Matheson spoke about are horrendous. If a social worker saw those conditions, that would be a neglectful home.
But that person wasn't allowed to go in.
Well, I don't want to speak to the article that he said.
Right.
But I gave an example.
Maybe perhaps in that.
Yeah, I gave an example of that.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
We had a home this year where a large family resided in, that when you walked past that home, you would have thought it's a middle class home. And you would assume that inside everything was great. There was a medical emergency. The emergency responders went in the home, and the next thing they did, they called us, because once they walked in the door, it was not. It was horrendously neglectful. Now, what's interesting is there was a large family, so those kids did not present to the school like they were living in that type of environment, but they were.
Well, I have about 4 pages of questions that I'll follow up with you.
All right.
Over the next few weeks. I know that some other committee members had questions.
Yeah.
With this list of people that you work with, it seems like during a handoff of a case like this, or when somebody's going to take part of the responsibility, there's the chance that it gets lost in a, you know, maybe didn't quite get the handoff all the way there. Is there somebody that's overseeing this whole process to make sure that everybody's coming along and doing what they're supposed
yeah,
to be doing?
Yeah, well, that's the job of the county social worker. And then, so the case, if it's going to get in the court system, so there's going to be 2 workers on that case. There's going to be the initial assessment worker who has a supervisor. And once that case goes into court, it's going to be transferred to the ongoing services unit. And ideally, they're going to have that same worker for the rest of the life of that case. And then these other partners, they're going to create this permanency plan, the case plan, and they're in charge of managing that. They're
yes.
in charge, the ongoing social worker.
Okay.
And they're in charge of making sure that if mom is in therapy, who is the therapist, when is she going, how often is she going? They're getting reports, they're getting releases of information signed by everybody that the parents are working with, and they're keeping contact with the foster parent. Then they have a supervisor that is staffing their cases with them. So every social worker has a formal meeting with their supervisor once a week. Now, if they have a caseload of 14 families, they may not cover all 14 every week, but in the course of 2 weeks, they're gonna cover all 14. And they're gonna find out where the case progress is. And then we have other mechanisms, staffing mechanisms. So when kids are going to go home, and we have parents are making progress. If we put this one program in, our intensive aftercare reunification program, we have a formal staffing on those cases every 6 to 8 weeks, where we include the supervisor, I sit on those, or the division manager, and we have 2 consulting psychologists that sit on that. That we, and the reason we do that is These parents often have significant drug abuse, neglect, drug abuse histories, or mental health issues. So they're there to help guide that clinical oversight to make sure that the social worker isn't missing anything. And then they're getting those frequent checks that I talked about. So that's our role. That's our role, is to manage all this. Yeah.
Any other committee members?
Well, through the chair to Mr. Rogers.
Yeah.
This last slide you gave us, you mentioned one thing unique about Kenosha is that we work with all of these partners and try to find a way to improve the system.
Correct.
And so this is a critically important thing, the work you guys do. I mean, you know that. I don't have to say that. But when you see something didn't go right, some outcome didn't work, the system didn't work the way it was supposed to work, do you have an internal process where you look at, you know, what, you know, this, they contacted our system, they tried to work through it, it didn't work, and now you go back and review your system to see if you can correct it so that doesn't repeat, or so you reduce the error rate?
We have done that on certain cases where we will pull together people and do interviews with staff and go through that process. The state, if you have what they call an egregious incident where a child has died, and the state will do their own review of that, and they will review all the materials. All the case record is electronic now. I mean, there is still some documents that are only in paper, but very few. Most are all in the electronic case record. They will review that. They will invite someone from the county to attend a debriefing meeting, and they then produce that feedback to the counties.
So the state of Wisconsin has oversight over what you do?
Correct.
And if something didn't go right, they come in and take a look?
That's their role. That's their role. They supervise the whole system. Right. And they do that with every county.
We only have maybe just a couple more minutes. I know Supervisor Thomas wanted to ask some questions.
Yes. If any of the committee members.
Were there any other committee members who had questions?
I have a list of questions, so I don't want you to, you don't even have to answer any of them. But it sounds like you, and thank you guys all very, it would break my heart to do this every day. And in saying that, I can't imagine the stuff you guys encounter. And I know very little about all of this, just very superficial. But you guys are like a 911 center if you're getting all these calls every day.
Right.
Right. Do you guys track the calls by who calls, what they're calling for, what time of day they call, and the purpose of the call? Do you have that type of granular?
Well, literally every call, every call that comes in, it has to be set up as either a Child Protective Service report they call it a Child Welfare Services intake. So they're literally documented when they call.
Have that information?
It is not as easy to pull all that in aggregate. What we can pull, how many calls we got, the ones that were screened in, what was the alleged maltreatment, ones that were screened out, what was the reason we did not screen them in. The reporter is confidential, so that information is in the record, but we're not supposed to share that.
You can look at just pure data, right?
Yeah, we can look at pure data.
So I'm just going to go on to the next one, because I have a bunch of them. So, you guys are very much a reactive agency, I would say, right? Everything you do is something had to happen first. Then you guys go. Is there any process where, through the help of these partners that you have out there, you profile children or parents?
Through our prevention services network, which I didn't present today.
Right, so but that's under this?
That's under this division. Okay. There's an arm of the division that has services for voluntary services to strengthen families and to keep them resilient to prevent child abuse.
Okay, so there's an aspect of that.
Yeah.
And one of the things that seems like the numbers are pretty steady as far as the number of calls and those type of things, but our overall population from 0 to 18 has declined significantly over the years. But you're still seeing the same number of cases, but it doesn't look like the parents' numbers have changed substantially. Are you seeing, and I'm looking at the number of kids per families on there, and it looks like it's maybe 1.8.
Yeah, you are a math person if you caught that. Yes, you caught that.
You know, so do you find that like two kids, or is it really more like families that have five or six kids?
When you, if you crunch numbers, it, no, the average is just below two. If you looked at that one slide, 70 families came in. If it was two children per family, you should have 140 children.
Yeah.
They will represent 113.
You know, just like you would reference though, that Milwaukee County sort of skews the overall state
right.
numbers. I was just curious if there's, you know, 50 families that have five or more kids, it's sort of skewed.
Oh, I don't normally track. We don't normally track it that way. Everyone knows when a large family comes in because it's a lot of kids to manage.
And so when this happens,
we're gonna have to wrap it up.
Okay, mm-hmm. Well, then I'm
gonna. Thank you.
All right.
Thank
you. I'm just curious.
Motion to adjourn.
Second.
All right. I move.
Move and second.
Anybody back?
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All right, good to see you. I hope you're feeling better. Glad it went well. Where'd you get it done? Here? Yes? Good?
Yeah.
Very cool. Good. My friend who had this done doesn't live anywhere near here.
Are you coming to the house? Are you going to go home and study?
He is, says the best thing he ever did. He wished he would have done.
I think everything is pretty much as always.
Oh, really? That's great.
Well, because we're still in 2022, so
forces this needle.
Yeah. Throws behind, like, because we're still in 2022, so
there's
still highly data. So in 2022,
good luck. Are you going to get